Hello, and welcome back to Elder Sign, a weird fiction podcast by Clay Temple Media. I'm Glenn McDorman.
And I'm Brendan Buddha. In today's episode, we'll be looking at Doom of the Savage Kings. This is an adventure written by Harley Stroh for the RPG Dungeon Crawl Classics. This was published in 2012.
This is the third installment in our role-playing game series, and this is the first time in which we are going to devote the entire episode to talking about an adventure. It's not going to be the last time we do that, but it is here the first one. So we've moved from beginning by looking at a core book, looking at really kind of an entire role-playing game. Then we've looked at a setting book that had an example adventure in it. And today we are just going to look at an adventure as a type of story. Before we get into that, we should talk about Dungeon Crawl Classics a little bit. This is a game that is really a rule set that mimics early versions of Dungeons & Dragons. It has simpler rules than today's version of Dungeons & Dragons does, and it is geared more towards combat. Dungeon Crawl Classics, or DCC as people will call it, is part of what's called the Old School Renaissance, which is a movement that, I don't know, at this point is probably 20 years old, but a movement towards going back to what Dungeons & Dragons felt like in the 1970s and the 1980s. And there are a bazillion games that will try to give that to you, but I think this is one of the more successful, one of the more popular versions of that. But of course, we should also remind people that you and I, Brendan, do not actively play role-playing games, so I don't have any experience playing Dungeon Crawl Classics. Do you have any experience with this game?
No, in fact, I had only just heard about it, not because of our coverage of role-playing games on Eldersign, but because not too long ago, Humble Bundle had a set of Dungeon Crawl Classics books, like, I don't know, 100 to 200, I don't know, a million of them for like, you know, $25 or whatever. And I was like, what is this? So I looked into it a little bit then. But man, am I glad we covered this and we're reading it. I loved this setting. I loved this adventure. I'm going to talk about why that is, why it was kind of suited to my tastes as a sort of fantasy adventure. And it may not be the reasons people guess, but this was a delightful story to get lost in for, you know, the week.
Yeah, I absolutely love this. We picked this more or less randomly. It comes out of Dungeon Crawl Classics Tome of Adventure Volume 1, and it's the first adventure in there, and that's really how we got here. But I was surprised to discover that it's absolutely amazing, and yeah, we will certainly get into those details of why we think so, but let's talk about the setting here first. But the very first thing that I should say is that this is the exact plot of Beowulf. That is going to be an entire segment of the show later on, but I want to be upfront that we know that so that you, dear listener, as you are hearing it obviously sound like Beowulf, you will not shake your fist at the fact that we are not talking about how it's exactly the plot of Beowulf. We know that. We will do an entire segment on that at the end of the episode. But let's talk about the game, or this adventure really, as an adventure. It is set in a sword and sorcery style fantasy village that is adjacent to some windswept moors. There's also a nearby burial mound that should definitely have us all thinking of Sutton Hoo. And so ultimately what we're looking at here is a fantasy version of early Anglo-Saxon England, or, you know, maybe it's a fantasy version of early medieval Denmark. The adventure hook is that there is a monster eating the villagers. The monster is a devil hound that has escaped its supernatural prison in this nearby burial mound. And so we probably also should be thinking a little bit about the Hound of the Baskervilles here as well, though this is, I will be clear, very definitely a supernatural monster that must be defeated by supernatural means. At this point, as the story begins, the villagers have taken to offering up human sacrifices to the hound so that the hound doesn't have to come into the village and prey on them randomly anymore. And our heroes, our player characters, that is, are here to solve this village's devil hound problem. And the adventure uses a three-act structure in which players follow the trail of the hound through three different locations. We start in the village of Herat, where the players will hear rumors about the ancient weapons which can be used to defeat the Hound. And from there, they go to the tomb of Ulfhenar to get those weapons. And then the next and final stop is the Sunken Fens, where the players will, well, definitely fight, but hopefully also slay the Hound with the supernatural weapons that they got from the tomb. And that's the background. That's also the adventure in a small nutshell here. And I think that this is an absolutely fantastic story. I mean, you know, Beowulf, it's a classic for a reason, right? But I also love and really admire that everything I just said, I mean, maybe not the Beowulf stuff, but everything else that I just said is on page one of this adventure. It is very nicely laid out to let you as a player or a game master spend a few minutes with this and then just decide if it's for you or not. And I think that's wonderful.
It is. And I think it really is. I mean, many of these core books or role-playing guidebooks are geared towards the game masters to wrap their head around the whole story and design a campaign for their friends or for their role-playing groups. And yeah, you're right to point out that this lets you know, like on page one, if this is the kind of adventure you want to do. But you get so much other material here that I think to go through this book as a player would almost spoil the experience for you. And we're going to try to not do that, I think, as we go through this adventure.
Yeah, the general rule of role-playing games is that you don't buy the adventures unless you're going to be the one running them, or at least you don't read them. And so I guess we should probably say that, I mean, we're definitely going to spoil everything that's in this adventure, right? So if you are, some reason, listening to this because you found it on the internet because you're about to be a player in this adventure, don't listen to our episode. To come back after you have played it, that would be fine. But don't listen to it ahead of time if you are planning to play this. Because, yeah, I mean, some of the thrill of the game master's storytelling choices will, you're going to miss that if you know what's going on. But something else that, you know, we have been talking about in the previous two episodes that we have done here in this series are thinking about role-playing games as a type of storytelling, how that relates to the type of storytelling that we normally cover here on the show. But also, of course, that type of storytelling is the type of storytelling that you and I like to craft ourselves as writers. And something that I was in awe of about this first page and this really neat summary of just everything that you need to know about what this story is that it functions as the outline of the story and then, you know, tells the game master that the fun part about this is going to be fleshing all of that out and seeing what choices your characters make, your player characters make in these different locations and how it is that they get from setting A or location A to location B to location C. And I felt like this is the type of tool that I actually need in front of me when I am writing a story. And it's not really the way that I write, but I think probably help me immensely sometimes to actually know what the story is before I start writing it.
I think that's right. There's this idea that we keep coming across in these books that will probably help us in our writing, which is if you're writing an adventure story or an investigation story or something pulpy, you probably need set pieces, right? And that's what we're talking about here. These are the set pieces. This is the place where something is going to happen. And this is the next place you have where you should write, you know, a battle or a combat or something to excite the reader and move the story forward. And I think neither you nor I like to think about those sorts of things in our writing, for better or worse. And this kind of approaching a story in this way, saying, okay, I need three set pieces, and I need to get my characters from point A to point, you know, Z, from A to Z to go through the story. Here are the set pieces they need to go to. Now it's my job to connect the dots. That might be something that we could do, you know, as an experiment to kind of stretch our own skill as writers.
Yeah, and certainly something, of course, that we could do for each other and that our listeners who are writers as well could do in community with each other or other people that they know who write is write these one-page things and then, or, you know, write one of these one-page summaries and give it to someone else to actually turn into the story, you know, give it a real kind of, not just a story prompt, but a story outline and then say, but now you go write it. You figure out how all of this is connected, which I think, that's maybe, you know, when you and I are no longer parents of little kids and are parents of teenagers who don't want anything to do with us. we could maybe start doing this sort of thing, you know, a decade hence or so.
Yeah, that's let's put on the list of things to do a decade from now. That would yeah, that's the idea.
Yeah, I think you might be joking about that, but listeners will not be surprised at all to know that I have exactly a list like that on my my computer desktop. But all right, let's not talk about that. Let's talk about this adventure. The thing we're going to do here next is just go through these locations, talk about what they're like, the NPCs that we might find there, or the type of gaming, the type of storytelling that we might find there. There are three of these locations. We're just going to go back and forth. Brandon's going to start us off by talking about the first of these locations where the adventure starts, which is the village.
Yes, this is the village of, I'm saying Hiro because it's spelled H-I-R-O-T, and I know there's no reason why it should be French, but I don't know why that stuck in my head. It's spelled like it should be a French word and a play on the word hero, but I don't know what the pun is here. There might be many.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that might even be one of them. And I think, yeah, it does kind of look French, that I and then the OT. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it definitely looks French. Someone could see that as French, but it is definitely actually Anglo-Saxon. This is the name of the village in the first act of Beowulf as well. It's spelled a little bit differently. It's instead of that I, it's an E-O, or at least, you know, that's how it gets rendered into modern English. And so it's pronounced something like Herat, though it also kind of looks like Hi-Rot. And, you know, there is certainly something rotten here to be thinking about, perhaps another important English story that actually takes place in Denmark.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I mean, there's, I don't know, this is a fun, this, there's so much fun energy in general in this story, just from the style of prose and so on. This is, I don't know, a book I'd recommend if you're into role-playing games. Anyway, yes, let's talk about the village here. This is where the adventure begins. And I don't know, another thing that's great about this adventure book is that it's got lots of visual aids to help you clearly conceive of the space, the place that you and your merry band of adventurers will be playing in. And to give a sense of the visual aid here, I think if you've played the game Skyrim, which came out a year before this was published, you know, and Skyrim is, you know, meant to be more Nordic, or, you know, thinking about a small English village or something. We've got an enclosed gate. There's a authority called the Jarl, who was, you know, who's the leader. And then there's a warrior class living, you know, just beneath them called Thanes and so on. This is the town of Herat. It is a Skyrim location. It's also Beowulf. The pictures kind of bear this out. And there's even a sketch on graph paper that you can use for your own sake as a dungeon master or a game master here. It's fantastic. So you and your adventurers might enter the town through the gate, which is guarded, and then there's a way from the gate, and by a way, I mean like a road or something like that, you know, a path going up to the Great Hall or Mead Hall, where, you can drink mead and hide from the Beast of Herat, perhaps on particularly bad nights, though. That's not where everybody gathers in this village. They gather at one of the inns, but I'll get to that in a moment. Now, one thing you might notice as you go through the town is that it once had a robust population, and it must have been opened to merchants and trade and so on, something like that, because there are two inns in town. I mean, there's one inn and there's a flop house. This is a weird economic note for me. Maybe for a Jarl and Thane-based society, because trade isn't really brought up in this game and everybody seems to be doing their own farming. But you can certainly understand a decision like this, again, if you've played Skyrim. I think Skyrim is a kind of a core reference to some of the conceiving of this town, though also English history or Danish history. I'm no expert in this period when mead halls were common. So I could just be wrong about the number of inns that a village could support.
Well, it would be zero. There would be no inns. That's the thing. I mean, we're told the population here is 300, and this just is a world, you know, if we're thinking about really the 6th century, if we're thinking historically about when Beowulf is set in this part of the world, there simply wouldn't be inns. People, travelers, would have places to stay. The Mead House, in fact, would be one of them. There would be some others, but there aren't hotels. This is not a world that knows about hotels. They haven't invented this idea of hotel yet. I mean, like other parts of the world have that at this point, but not this part of the world. These are here because it's a sword and sorcery story. You have to have an inn. You have to have a flop house. You have to have some kind of place where your player characters, or just the protagonists of your sword and sorcery short story, can get something to drink and meet the locals and hear news that turns out to be clues about what is going on here. And also, you know, clues about or angles into points of conflict within the community. So yeah, this is just straight out of any Robert E. Howard story.
Yes, yes.
Any Fawford and the Grey Mouser story. I mean, it's just pure sword and sorcery.
It's pure sword and sorcery. It is pure fun. But the Mead Hall would be the place for this, right? That's like the town hall. That is the seat of power, but also the villages where they would gather. They could, whatever. We're getting really sidetracked here because this kind of got stuck in my head here of wondering, why are there two inns here? What's going on? Where's the trade? What's happening? Anyway, another thing we need to know as we walk through this town is that because the population has been decimated to some degree, there's no shortage of abandoned homes and so on. But if you're trying to get information about what's going on, you can still knock on doors. You can stop by the village square, attend church services at the chapel, which are kind of populated by the same priest of whatever religion is dominant in this village. You can buy goods at the market. You can investigate local superstition and so on before you head out into the wild to confront the foe that is threatening this once peaceful village. And all in all, this is exactly the sort of place where you'd want to start an adventure. And I recommend, you know, you stop at the Wolf Spear Inn. Maybe the name is evocative of something you might need along your way. It is also a safe haven. If you spend some evenings in the village, you will be stuck there for an evening while the beast prowls and while the villagers have, by lottery, chosen someone to be sacrificed to the beast, which one of your adventurers might get chosen in that lottery. You can chat with the local bard and meet lots of villagers here as well. You might also want to be knocking on doors and knock on the door of the home of the local mad widow. Certainly this is something the Lord would want you to do, but she might have something of use for you in your adventure as well. You know, I think in general, when not besieged by a mysterious beast, Herat would be a nice place to live. Except for maybe a couple of the NPCs that we'll meet later that we should probably drive out should we become Jarl someday.
Yeah, there's a big cast of NPCs here in this village. Did you have a favorite?
I did. I mean, I feel like maybe it's not favorite, but I feel like we have to talk about the Jarl and Wormtongue here. I mean, his name is Sil Rue in this story, in this adventure. But this game, one reason I want to bring this up here, this character, Sil Rue, is a kind of a weakly wizard figure who's sapping the Jarl's power by manipulating him and whispering into his ear, is a phrase the text use. And I'm bringing this up here because I want to point out how this game tugs on those familiarity and nostalgia strings. And as a middle-aged father of, you know, young children, this is the sort of thing that I can really get behind for a beer and pretzels kind of game night with friends, because you don't have to do a lot of, there's not a huge cognitive load in understanding the setting, at least for me. And these types of stock characters taken from sword and sorcery tales that we've brought up, or even Lord of the Rings, as we're seeing now here, is just enough of an association to just have fun and have a light adventure evening with friends. I'll say more about Sil Rue here. He's too powerful for the sake of the people here. He's a corrupted human being. He sapped the strength of the Jarl by forcing the Jarl to become dependent on him, and his really taken away the Jarl's ability to make decisions by himself. And so Sil Rue is the one behind the sacrifice system and the lottery system. You know, he's a Rasputin meets Wormtongue sort of character. And they're always together. They're kind of mentioned as a pair. You're never going to get the Jarl by himself, but as Dungeon Master, you can really do whatever you want here. I also love the Mad Widow of Ymir. That's just some classic sorcery stuff here that I love to see in a tale like this.
Yeah, the Mad Widow is great. That was the one character where I thought, yes, if you're the game master here and you get to actually play this character, yeah, I would want a wig. I would want some makeup, you know, they do a quick change somehow. Yeah. And I would work on my voice for the Mad Widow all week. I might try to use some, some kind of smoke machine to get some kind of effect in the room. All of that sort of stuff, I think, would be just super fun about the Mad Widow character for sure. The Seer is also really interesting. 100%. Is Wormtongue. Something we should probably also add here, it's maybe not of any real consequence, but the lottery system here is totally rigged. And it is the Seer who is rigging it and is clearly using it to get rid of people he doesn't like in town. And the Seer is also interesting because, you know, he is this representative of an older religion that people, at least on the surface, have converted away from, and there is perhaps here some resurgence of the religion possible. We'll talk more about religion later in the episode, although actually we can talk a little bit more about it right now, because the character I really gravitated towards here was Father Beacom. And as that name suggests, Father Beacom is a religious figure. He is a cleric of some sort. The title Father is Christian, of course, but Christianity itself doesn't exist in this secondary world. And so he's not a Christian priest. He's a priest of Justicia, which is to say justice. That's the Latin word for justice. But nonetheless, this religion has many of the characteristics of Christianity, to include Father Beacom's belief that the hound is here as a punishment for the villagers' sins. And to this end, Father Beacom likes to stand in the middle of the village and harangue everyone about repenting and how the end is nigh and that sort of thing. And inside his church, and this church, I should say, is the only structure in the village that is made entirely of stone. But inside his church, there are two items of interest. And the first is a totally anachronistic stained glass window that here depicts Justicia battling a devil hound with a giant warhammer. And the other item of interest is the giant warhammer itself, or at least the head of it, which is now serving as the altar. And the characters can take this hammerhead turned altar and convert it back to a weapon and, you know, get some special bonuses for fighting the hound, right? But of course, Father Beacom doesn't want to let the party take the altar. And so here there is a potential, you know, point of conflict where you're actually roughing up a priest and stealing his altar from him, which is 100% the sort of things that murder hobos who play D&D like to do.
Yeah, well, even with the Mad Widow that we've been talking about, there is this potential point of conflict. She offers you a magical item to bind the beast, which the beast has to be bound before it's killed, in return for marriage. So one of your characters might be ending up staying in this village, though marriage doesn't mean they're trapped there. You can still go on adventures, and they live in Herat for the rest of their lives with the Mad Widow of Ymir. But there's really interesting, I mean, the religious piece is fascinating here. We have these conflicting religions in this small village, which itself is really interesting. But then you also have these great points of conflict, these ways to pick up all the tools you need for your adventure, which makes sense because because the beast is a local beast. It's a local superstition. It's a local legend. So all of the things you need might be found in tombs, or people might have brought them back from things they found in the field, or they might be magicians themselves. And it's a great way to really locate the adventure in a sense of place. It's not globetrotting. You don't need to track down the Grail Journal, and then you need to track down the spear that pierced Christ's side, or like all of these relics, whatever it is. There's a reason why you can kind of stay local in this quest. And I think that that's a really great touch from these writers.
Right. Well, let's stay local here as we go to the next location, which is the tomb of the Ulfinar, who is a long dead savage warlord. He's, you know, at least one of the savage kings in the title of the adventure. And his tomb is the burial mound to the north of the village, which it turns out is in the shape of a serpent. In order to get into the burial mound, the heroes have to roll a massive boulder away, but the entrance is guarded by the spirit of a giant serpent. There's also a foot-deep pool of water in front of the entrance, so this 100% feels like getting into the Mines of Moria here, where, you know, something grabs hold of you while you're in the water, and then you have to deal with it before you can actually get into the underground place that you shouldn't be trying to get into, but are trying to get into for some reason. At any rate, once inside, there is a ton to explore here. One thing to say is that the walls and ceilings are tall stone slabs, which were set in place before the dirt was then put all over it, right? That's how you built this mound. And so there is no natural light in here, or at least not in most of it. There are some tracks from the Devil Hound, and you can see that, you know, the Devil Hound was looking for an exit. Some of the places in here are covered in slime. And of course, because this is, you know, an old school type of adventure, there are traps everywhere that you, the player characters, need to avoid. There are tombs for warriors who were buried with the Ulfhanar, and some of those warriors are now ghouls. So, you know, watch out for that, right? Finally, there is the tomb of the Ulfhanar himself. He now is a skeleton on a throne. The tomb is surprisingly free of traps or monsters. It does, of course, though, contain the supernatural weapons that the heroes need so that they can go, well, not fight, but defeat the hound. And this especially means the wolf spear, which of course was, you know, the name of the inn in the village, but also the Horn of Kings, which has some healing powers that might come in handy as well. All in all, the Serpent Mound, well, I mean, it just looks like it's a really fun dungeon crawl, but one of the things that I really liked about it, to go back to an example that you were also just invoking, Brandon, this feels like it takes a lot of cues from Indiana Jones, maybe a little more Raiders, a little more Temple of Doom, but definitely taking some cues from Indiana Jones here.
Absolutely, yeah. And it is just the most classic kind of dungeon crawl. Again, like I said, the visual aids here are done on graph paper, though the drawings are really cool. It's kind of like, I don't know how to say this. I hope it's not not diminishing to anybody's talent who worked on this, but the art is very kind of juvenile or amateurish in a really great way. Like they look like awesome complex doodles you'd see by an extraordinarily talented high school artist who's really into this sort of thing, and I mean that in the absolute best possible way and with the most respect here. This is not something I could do. But yeah, you get a map of the tomb that lets you as the dungeon master. Like I said, this is made for ease of play and for fun. And this is just a really like, let's just jump in and have a great time. But the dungeon master can just use this stuff, expand on it, or throw it away. But it's all here for you to really visualize the adventure that you're setting up for your buddies.
Yeah, the art is fantastic in this book, and that is an intentional style. This is all meant to, well, look like this looked in the 1970s, late 1970s and early 1980s, when adventures like this were being printed in magazines, but also just in fanzines that people were mimeographing and you could get mailed to you. It is meant to evoke all of that, though this, I think, looks much better than that material did. But it is definitely a very specific style that is done here extraordinarily well. I visually responded to just flipping through this adventure and flipping through the entire book that this adventure is in. It's all awesome. And I think this continues as we get into the final location here. I liked a lot of the images that we get for the Sunken Fens and the Lair of the Hound.
Right. The Sunken Fens are a truly wild place. There's no clear path through. People don't travel through the Sunken Fens. Foul mud sucks at your boots, and sulfur dominates the olfactory category experience here as you're moving through them. Of real concern in the Sunken Fens is the fact that you are lost this far into the adventure, and you have to really navigate this area. But you'd also be forgiven if you get very concerned about all of the swamp jackals that are around, or maybe you're worried about the sentient Tyndalos vines that are constantly trying to tangle you up and eat me. And these vines reminded me of Scott Smith's novel, The Ruins, which is, I don't know, a favorite of mine in terms of horror novels. And I don't know, if you're into that sort of thing and sentient plants, that book might be for you. That's our Reading Rainbow moment of the day. But let's say that you and your adventurers do find your way through the fire swamp and end up at the lair of the hound. Well, this is where you fight the hound, as you might imagine. You can also get unimaginable treasure and benefits here. But you have to try very hard not to stare too deeply into the black pool, which may stare back into you and cause a crisis of faith or something like that. And as rooted as the in earthly existence as the lair may seem, you're quick to realize that it is otherworldly entirely. And, you know, when you get here, you have to kill the hound of Herat once and for all by binding it and killing it with a mystical weapon.
This was probably my favorite location here, but one of the things, just generally speaking, that I really enjoyed about this adventure is that we've got these three distinct locations. What you're going to do with them is going to change, you know, game to game and, you know, gaming group to gaming group. But I like the progression here of we've got act one or location one is that you're dealing with human society and human motivations and navigating that, doing a lot of talking. Then you go from that to a classic dungeon crawl where you're literally underground. There are traps, there are monsters to fight. And, you know, in that location, you are wrestling with the legacy of the past in a real visceral way because, well, some of the legacy of the past is people who've turned into ghouls and are trying to kill you, right? And people who have set traps to jealously guard their treasure and so on. And then you leave that, though, and you get straight into some wilderness horror that, as you're alluding to here, Brandon, has a real cosmic horror sense to it as well. You invoke the ruins, which I think that's also a film, right? And I've neither that's seen right. the film yeah. nor read the book, but a lot of the descriptions here really had me in mind of The Willows by Algernon Blackwood, which you and I are honor-bound to cover on Patreon as soon as our schedules clear up. I think it's next year that we're planning to finally get to that that bonus series. But this was probably my favorite part of it. I love wilderness horror in general, and especially when it gets given this cosmic horror tinge to it. And I just loved the location changes here where you get different types of horror and different types of gameplay in each of these locations. So there's a little something for everyone in your gaming group. It's just, it's really well thought out.
And also kind of keeping in line with the contemporary references and nostalgia and familiarity element. I mean, I called it the fire swamp, the savage fens or whatever they're called here. And there is, you know, the swamp jackals, you know, might put you in mind of rodents of unusual size and so on. So there's like this kind of fun, almost Princess Bride-esque romp through this area too, that I think works well. I think whatever references you have that tie you to the world of fantasy, you can tug on for use in this adventure to make it kind of a familiar romp for you and your friends.
Definitely. And it's certainly up to you as the game master and also with, you know, your players as a gaming group, how exactly it is that you want to go about taking these locations and connecting them. I mean, there's a pretty clear layout here in the adventure, but of course you could play around with that. And maybe this is the part where we should segue into thinking about this as, well, as a story. How does this work for you as a story?
Real well. I want to kind of run through the basic narrative here, and then we can kind of dig into whether or not we think it works or why we think it works and so on. But the basic narrative is this. Things have gotten bad in Herat. Silru, the Jarl's confidant, has gained too much power and has gotten the town to agree to sacrifice one of their own every 3 days at an altar visited by this mysterious and wicked beast. The beast is only recently a problem for Herat because 6 months ago, some rogue tomb raiders broke into this tomb of the savage king and set the beast free by accident. And so you and your mighty band of adventurers come to town, learn that the beast can be harmed by mortal weapons, but not slain by them. So you have to investigate to discover how to kill the beast while keeping the villagers alive until you determine what weapon you will use to first bind the beast and then kill the beast once and for all by bringing the fight to the Hound of Herat in his loathsome lair. Along the way, you'll investigate the village of Herat and its prominent inhabitants to see if anything from the druidic past or the time of the Savage Kings has survived to aid you on your quest. Perhaps one of your party will agree to marry an old widow in exchange for a binding weapon. Perhaps you'll expose Silru's cowardice and treachery to the Jarl, though what good that will do now is anyone's guess. You'll travel to and explore the tomb of Ulfinar, where the beast once lurked, to discover if some weapon was left behind for your use, along with anything left to loot, of course. And then you'll travel to the lair itself and confront the beast and the Black Pool as well. Have you learned enough about the beast on your travels to succeed in this final task? I hope you've investigated the townspeople in the tomb well enough to get what you need. And yeah, I love the setup for this story, Clint. I think it's great. It's pure comfort food that will either be a great entry for tabletop role-playing games for beginner players, you know, a great one-shot or a 4 or 5 night campaign. Like, I'd love to run this game for my nephew someday, maybe, who'd recognize some of the various fantasy tropes here and be excited about them. Or, you know, I'd like to be a player of this who maybe on a game night, I just need to chill out and have more conversation than focus because I spend all day talking to a 2-year-old who struggles to speak back. So, yeah, this is a hangout game. It's a fun, familiar tale. I love it. It's got intrigue, romance, adventure, weird religion, and horror. I mean, what more do you need?
Yeah, I 100% fantasized about how this is going to be the adventure that I run for our kids when they are 10 or 11, right? Whenever you're around or we're visiting your part of America or something like that. But I 100% was envisioning this as a wonderful introductory adventure for how to play a role-playing game, but also to really just think about story structures as well, right? It's a great tool for that also. And so, yeah, I'm utterly in awe of this. I mean, we're going to talk about the Beowulf stuff eventually, which of course is, you know, my thing. That gets me really excited. But even without the fact that this is Beowulf turned into a role-playing game, I just loved the simplicity of the design here, the focus on the setting, really above all else, but then also just the fast-paced and very clear plotting for this, where you know what you're supposed to be doing in each location and why you're going from location to location, that there's a real engine just built into this story that propels everything ever forward.
It is a real masterpiece of that kind of writing. In as we said, setting up the set pieces, building the story around it, but also, yeah, pulling on this classic bit of literature, Beowulf, and saying, let's use that as a frame. Somebody needs to do a Gilgamesh role-playing game somehow. I don't know how that would work, but somebody's got to do it.
Well, let's do it. Let's talk about Beowulf here, really, before we start comparing Beowulf with Doom of the Savage Kings and connecting some dots. Let me just do a little bit of orienting here. Beowulf is a heroic poem. It was written in the early medieval form of English that is either called Anglo-Saxon or Old English. Both terms are fine. Old English is more in vogue now. This, I don't know, comes and goes every 20 years, whether people are calling it Anglo-Saxon or Old English. So you'll see both. At any rate, Beowulf has survived in a single manuscript, just one manuscript that we can date from more or less around the year 1000. But beyond that, we have no definitive answer as to when the text of the poem was composed or how it was composed or by whom. And these are questions that definitely get people to do snap fights at academic conferences. I mean, there are like serious brawls about the answers to each of these questions about Beowulf. But no matter when it was written, no matter who wrote it or how it was composed, this poem is one of the foundational texts of English literature. It's often taught in schools. It used to be always taught in schools, but I will say that at least at this point here in the 2020s, none of my students have ever read it. So that seems to have gone away. But nonetheless, it used to be a cultural touch point. Tolkien worked on Beowulf. His own translation of it has recently been published. Also, Neil Gaiman wrote the script for the Robert Zemeckis film adaptation. Brent and I will definitely cover that someday. Also, there's a Star Trek episode about Beowulf, you know, like somebody's playing Beowulf on the holodeck and, you know, there's an accident. And so the characters are actually in the story of Beowulf. So yeah, it's all over, well, certainly all over the types of pop culture that we do here on the network. Also, I will say that if the voting had gone another way, right, if poetry had won instead of role-playing games, we would be doing a whole series on Beowulf as this important foundational bit of weird fiction. And it's probably a good place to segue into talking about the story itself. The story has three parts to it. The first two are set in 6th century Denmark at the Great Hall of Hrothgar, who is the king of the Danes. And Hrothgar is being preyed upon by a monster, we'll say. And Beowulf himself is a Geat from across the sea in Sweden. I mean, I say across the sea, but, you know, we're talking about 5 miles. Like, you could, you know, you could swim the distance if you were a strong swimmer. At any rate, Beowulf is here to fight the monster. And that monster's name is Grendel. Grendel cannot be pierced by blades, and so Beowulf defeats him by ripping off his arm, which, you know, that's a sensible thing to do. That is the end of the first part of Beowulf, and that's the part that really concerns us. I mean, obviously, the bones of the plot are exactly the same, but just for completionist's sake, I'll run through the other two parts here. The second part starts the very next night when Grendel's mother comes to the mead hall looking for revenge, and Beowulf has to defeat her as well. And then part three is chronologically distinct. This takes place when Beowulf is an old king. He's back in Sweden, and he dies fighting a dragon. And yeah, that's Beowulf in a nutshell. So maybe let's move into talking, you know, about the Beowulf material as it appears, as it's used here in Doom of the Savage Kings. And there are two things I want to talk about here. I promised earlier that we would talk about religion. This is where we'll do that. But I want to start by talking really just about, well, I was going to say the word environment here, but, you know, setting maybe is what we can be thinking about here. Look, there are fens, right? This is where we end up. We end up in the fens to fight the hound. And hey, Grendel and his mother live in a fen. Beowulf has to fight the mother there. So that's a real similarity. There are burial mounds in both of these stories. Beowulf gets a burial mound when he dies, though I don't think he's actually buried in that mound. So maybe it's more of a memorial mound than it is technically a burial mound. But nonetheless, a mound in honor of a dead person. This also is just a big part of Anglo-Saxon culture. I think I invoked Sutton Hoo earlier in the episode, which is the most famous of these. Hrothgar's hall is called Hrot, which is also the name of the village here, though spelled a little bit differently. And I'm not sure if that was to make us think it was French to give us this high rot pun, or, you know, what the goal there, what the idea there was of changing the spelling. But, you know, it's real on the nose, right, that the name is exactly the same. And, you know, to my mind, just, you know, when I'm reading Beowulf or just thinking about Beowulf, which is a thing that I do a lot, these environmental details, these setting details, really always stand out to me in the poem, especially the scene when Grendel flees to his lair in the middle of the fens or middle of the marsh after Beowulf rips off his arm. You know, that is also where Grendel's mother has her own lair. And the descriptions of these places in the text are just really wonderful. And I felt like this scenario, I felt like Doom of the Savage Kings has a strong sense of place that really drew me into, well, just the furniture and the mood of the story. I mean, I know we've said a lot about the plotting here and the storytelling elements, but for me, just the mood that this setting invokes is a real strong part of Doom of the Savage Kings. And all of that is lifted from Beowulf in this very clever way.
It really is. And it's not just Beowulf, which is the core reference. They've also, the writers here, or writer, has also understood the way that Beowulf has influenced for, you know, at the time of the writing of this, the contemporary cultural landscape of fantasy writing in general, including, you know, video games. I brought up Skyrim here, but also Tolkien's Lord of the Rings and so on. And thinking about not just the core text, the core primary text of this adventure, but then also the ways in which it's really, you can draw people into that by using more contemporary references. So it is, that is something really worth thinking about that makes the environment seem so vivid and real, is not just the visual aids we get here, but the way that the writer has understood Beowulf's staying power as a piece of English, Old English, or Anglo-Saxon literature.
Yeah, and I think that's really one of the strengths of what Sword and Sorcery does as well. And here even, I'm thinking back years now to when we covered our first Conan story. In fact, it was the first Conan story. Well, I guess we did that over on Patreon, but we've done some Conan here on Elder Sign as well. But at any rate, you know, one of the things we talked about in that episode was the way in which Robert E. Howard is not doing what Tolkien does. He's not inventing a secondary world, even though he is inventing a secondary world, right? But what he's doing is invoking all of these images that we have of days of yore, different types of days of yore, Roman past, an Egyptian past, and a Greek past, and so on, and populating his world with that and making it very obvious that that's what he's doing so that he doesn't have to invent a world and give us huge amounts of exposition about that world so that we understand it. He's trying to write stories that don't require an explanatory guidebook in order to understand. This adventure does exactly the same thing. It's just making all of the pop culture references, I mean, the greatest pop culture references of the year 1000, I guess, right? To make sure that we understand what is the furniture of this world. What is this world like? What does it look like? What does it sound like? What does it smell like, right? So that we can use our imagination to fill in those blanks. And the writers don't really have to do that. And the game master doesn't really have to do that very much either, that it's already living in our imagination. And this is one of the things that is so wonderful about Sword and Sorcery. I think it really, you know, it works for Robert E. Howard, works in Falford and the Grey Mouser and so on. And it definitely works here as well.
There's an understanding that comes with Sword and Sorcery that you are dealing with some kind of, you know, I know you don't love this phrase here, Glenn, but legendary history or like heroic past or something that evokes history, but is really rooted in our imagination of history or in the superstitions or mythologies that populate maybe the numinous past rather than the material past, though these are products of the material past and so on. And we don't need to get too deep into historiography unless you really want to, Glenn. But, just this power to evoke while maintaining that suspension of disbelief is something that I think is extraordinarily difficult to do well. And this is an example of it being done really well.
The world building here draws entirely on our idea of what the past was like and not really at all on what the past was actually right, like. And that's right. What you're invoking here. And this is a move that is actually made in the text here. And this is perhaps a good segue to move into the last thing that we'll talk about today, which is religion. Beowulf is famous, maybe infamous, for being a poem that was composed by a Christian and written down by a Christian, but nonetheless, a poem that depicts a pagan heroic past. And it's not shy about the fact that Hrothgar is a heathen, but still the text, the story, is full of references to the Old Testament. Beowulf himself, though not called a Christian in the text, may in fact be one. This is one of these things that there's a lot of debate about that will definitely prompt some snap fighting if you bring it up at an academic conference or, you know, at least a conference full of medievalists. At any rate, scholars have spent a ton of time looking at the use of Christianity in the poem, the influence of Christianity in the poem. But scholars also have been really curious about what a Christian with good knowledge of scripture finds so interesting, so compelling about this pre-Christian world. And we find something similar here in this scenario. This is clearly a world of warrior heroes, or at least it's a world of people who want to be like the warrior heroes of the past and maybe just kind of suck at it. But it is also a world that has adopted Christianity, or at least is in the process of doing so. And of course, it's not actually called Christianity here. This religion is nonetheless, rather obviously, an analog to Christianity here in this fantasy world. The biggest way that we can see that is that the name of the deity is in Latin, while the native language is clearly Germanic. So the religion then is an import, right? I think also the architecture of the church suggests that as well. And so really in the same way, you know, that Beowulf does, this Doom of the Savage Kings shows us a world that is grappling with two different religious traditions that have distinct ideas about heroism, distinct ideas about war, and that these are traditions that don't easily merge together, don't easily mesh together. And the last thing that I want to do here is to point to this depiction of the goddess Justicia fighting a devil hound with a warhammer. Now, I want to be upfront. There's nothing in the text that says so, but I completely feel like this is not a story that they are telling about Justicia back in whatever the analog to the Mediterranean is in this fantasy world. I think that this image here is the result of a missionary a generation ago, maybe two generations ago, inserting Justicia into existing stories of these Germanic people. There's clear real-world examples of this. I think the most famous one is this text called The Highland, which is a Germanic poem from the 9th century that tells the story of Christ, but it's not a story of the Gospels. It's not a story that we recognize from anything that's authentic to the genesis of Christianity. What this story does is, it tells us a story about Christ as if he's a warlord, similar to Hrothgar from Beowulf, or, you know, similar to a sword and sorcery hero, frankly. And I feel like something similar is going on in this scenario, right? Where the local people have taken this foreign religion and are appropriating it and just inserting its proper nouns into stories that they already have and stories that culturally make sense to them. This is, you know, certainly a way of engaging with, you know, legendary past or heroic past that I think the scenario is doing here. It's an effect that I absolutely adore, even if, you know, this doesn't matter at all to the gameplay. But nonetheless, this detail, I think, really made this world come alive for me, in that it just immediately suggests all of this dense backstory about cultural history and religious change and so on. That's just, you know, you get this description if you walk into the temple. And maybe you don't walk into the temple, so you don't get it in the game. But if you do, you can get this real heavy sense of this. And I loved it.
Yeah, you actually don't have to walk into the chapel of Justicia here in the game if you don't want to. You can get information from the father while he's outside telling people the end is nigh and screaming about their sins and so on, and the need to repent or turn to the religion. Yeah, the material reality of this village is an absolute mess. I mean, we've talked about the inns, how there are two inns here, and, like, you know, why would any town have an inn? Well, this town has an inn for the sake of there being the convention of adventurers meeting at an inn, eating stew, and getting a prompt to go out into the world. But we also see the stained glass window here. Again, that is here as a mode of evocation, a way to evoke the kind of wide-ranging, the power and majesty of this institutional religion that might be coming into being or has been established for some time, that even a town like Herat can have a chapel with something as ornate and difficult to install as a stained glass window. And that's right, Glenn. I mean, I think you're absolutely right to take that chapel here as a way to get this sense that this is a much, much bigger thing. And even the fact that this old magical weapon is the altar here is more evidence of the incorporation of the local stories into this cosmic religion that is other than what these townspeople have been exposed to perhaps in their recent past.
Yeah, and there is definitely some kind of religious conflict happening in this village, in that there is still a seer, even though this village and, you know, the Jarl have adopted this new religion, they still have the seer, who is clearly a holdover, right, from the pre-Justicia religion that these people have practiced, perhaps stripped of some of its religious trappings and now presented only in a supernatural sense, right? But there's no way that Father Beacom is, you know, cool with the Jarl still relying on this seer and believing in the supernatural powers of this seer. But one of the things that's happening here, right, is that the old stories, the old local stories, the pre-Justicia stories turn out to be true, right? Our adventurers come to town, come to the village, and find all the old weapons that do turn out to have all these magic properties. And in the end of this, right, it's possible that the villagers, or the adventurers rather, the players go back to the village and report about what's happened. And the seer can use this as a way of saying, see, like the old religion is actually the true religion. It was the tools, you know, the magical tools of my religion that undid, you know, defeated the hound, rather than, you know, anything having to do with Justicia. Though, of course, there is this business with the altar and the image in the stained glass and so on. So yeah, I feel like there's like a sequel adventure here. If you're interested in religious competition and that sort of thing, you could do a sequel here, I think, when the players get back to the village, and a sequel about what happens next, if you're into that sort of thing.
Well, that's even offered by this text itself, because you have in the Lair of the Hound, the Black Pool. And here's the description here. I'll read it. We haven't read any of text from any of these books so far, but here's an example of the writing. The Black Pool. Priests of all faiths are repulsed by the pool's weird otherworldly nature. Clerics meditating on the pool are mentally assaulted by a profound crisis of faith and must attempt a DC 10. A will save, it says here, or be stripped of all clerical abilities for one. You roll a D20 and that's how many days you don't have your powers. So your character, if they are of a religious bent or using some kind of religious magic here, can be brought into confrontation with this real mode of otherworldly or weird magic, or this weird thing in the world. And so there is this tension in the imagining of this place where there is a new religion and old magic. And it's wonderful. It's such a rich rich vein to mine, in the storytelling of this world.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I can't recommend this adventure enough. I had, as we talked about, you know, never really encountered Dungeon Crawl classics before. We have the entire, you know, first volume adventure tome here. This is the only one that we have looked at, but this one made me really excited to look at more. And I'm so glad, so thrilled that our listeners chose for us to be covering role-playing games this year.
Yeah, it's been really enlightening for me. And as I've said, I mean, part of it is just thinking about craft as a writer, and that's something hopefully we'll continue to look at, you know, the ways in which role-playing games are an important mode of storytelling and in group storytelling, but also in which they can be prompts for you to think about ways to tighten up your own writing or a new approach to your own craft as a storyteller. But I think we talked about that here today, and we've covered this adventure well enough. So that is going to do it for this episode. Once again, I'm Brandon Buda.
And I'm Glenn McDorman. You can find us and our other creative projects at claytemplemedia.com. Please join us on Patreon at patreon.com/claytemplemedia so that you can gain access to over 100 bonus episodes. Next time, we're going to be back with something. We don't actually know what that is going to be yet, because we are recording episodes way out of order this year. And at the time of recording this episode, we have not yet had the vote to determine what it is that will be next. But I know that everything that's on the ballot is awesome, so it will be something that is awesome. And until next time, until then, we greet you and say farewell.